8:15, having arrived, I'm going to call the Education Finance Committee to order, and we do have a quorum, so if we could take care of the minutes first. And Representative McDonald, you're always so punctual here, and I just know you've been reading the minutes thoroughly and so forth. Would you care to? It's February 27th, March 4th, and March 5th.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is misspelled. McDonald is E-I-E-I-O at the end.
We will duly note that in the minutes and get that corrected for the next.
Yes, thank you. With that, I'll make a motion to approve the minutes.
Representative McDonald, thank you. Representative McDonald moves the approval of the February 27th, March 4th, March 5th, 2014 minutes. Any discussion to that? If not, I will call for the vote on that motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion carried. Those minutes are approved. Thank you very much. At this point, we now will have a conclusion on continuation, I guess, of the Minnesota Department of Education report from last week. And we have Mr. McHenry here to start with the assessment piece, and we will go from there. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kevin McHenry, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education. Originally, we did have our Assessment Director, Jennifer Dugan, here last week to provide this update, and she was unavailable this morning. So I'm pinch hitting for her. I'm just going to give a quick background on what passed legislatively last session, and then describe where we are at in the process of transforming our testing system. So. This first slide here is going to be an overview of our grade 3 through 7. The tests are moving to for mathematics and reading. Our tests need to be aligned to our Minnesota academic standards. The tests are going to be online. They're going to be adaptive. They're going to be predictive of for a college entrance exam. And they will include items that are not on a grade level basis, so they can so if a student's performing above, they can have some tougher questions. Also, our science standards are going to be, they'll be aligned to our Minnesota academic standards. And for grades 3 through 7, there's only a grade 5 science assessment. So moving forward for the 2014-15 school year, in math and reading, again, the standards are going to be, they will be aligned to the academic standards. What we're doing in the first year is moving to the 3 through 7 exams will start. However, they're not going to be adaptive until the 15-16 school year. What we'll be doing in the first year in 14 and 15 is making a big enough bank of questions so our assessment system can handle enough questions so they can be online and they can be adaptive. And again, for science, again, there's only going to be a grade 5 science assessment. Moving forward into the into more of the college placement and career placement suite of assessments, again, there's going to be an 8th and a 10th grade test. The 8th grade test is going to be in math, reading, and writing. Again, it has to be aligned to the Minnesota academic standards. They have to be predictive of a college entrance exam. And it also has to provide a career exploration element. In grade 10, the same factors are going to be included in the grade 10 test. Science, again, is going to be 8th and in high school. For grade 11, this is where we're getting into the college and career placement exam. If a student is not ready for the, if a student's going to need some remedial work, that's going to be determined through the 8th and 10th grade test. The student will be eligible to take a college placement diagnostic test. That has to be taken after they receive their score for their 10th grade test and prior to taking their college entrance exam. The purpose of this is to provide information of what the student needs to take for remedial classes to make sure that they can perform well on this college entrance exam. So where we're at right now in the current plans for making this transition. So in early 2014, right now, or first of all, what we did is we put out two RFPs for this exam, or this suite of assessments. The plan was we really wanted to make sure we had as much flexibility to do what the sign legislation was passed last session. And so in order to do that, what we did is we have two RFPs. One was an RFP for the grade 3 through 7 tests with the option of that RFP doing the 8th and 10th grade tests. The second RFP was for the college entrance exam with the opportunity to also include the 8th and 10th grade exam. For the first portion of that RFP, we do have a testing vendor contract signed, and that is with Pearson. The other contract we do not have signed at this moment. We are working towards having the contract signed as soon as possible so we can make some of these transitions that are included in this slide. We expect to have that done soon. We don't have a specific date of when that will happen. And at the same time, I do have to be a little bit careful, as that is in negotiations. I'm not at liberty or not allowed to legally say exactly what the specific negotiations are in that contract. But I can just what I can say is that we are doing everything we can to make sure that this contract will align to what the legislature and governor signed last session as we move forward. So in early 2014, as you can see, we'll be doing the analysis to determine the design and the pre-design and the prediction of the college entrance exam. In mid-2014, there's going to be some details based on the information we get from the testing vendors on how we can roll out the testing system for next school year, for 2014 and 15 school year. And that will include our test schedule, our high school test. It's going to include some work that has to be done for aligning our standards. We do have to go through a standard setting process to make sure that the tests are aligned to our Minnesota standards. So once that final contract is signed, that's going to be a process that we'll go through. So with that, I can stay open for questions, but that's where we're at right now in the negotiations and transitioning to this new college suite of assessments.
Thank you very much. Representative Quam has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. The recent announcement that there's going to be a transition in the state entrance exams, making the essay optional, looking at the vocabulary words being utilized and getting rid of some of the more obscure ones and having it more relational, mm-hmm. Is that evolution of philosophy, is the department aware of that and looking at trying to implement some of those improvements in the approaches and selection of tests?
Mr. McHenry?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I think what you're referring to is there's the information that SAT has put out of how they're updating their college suite of assessments. What I can say is that, what we have is we have an RFP that we put out, and it was open to any vendor that could provide a college entrance exam, and they could apply to win the contract. What I can say is there was only one vendor that applied for that contract, and that one vendor was ACT. So what SAT is doing is obviously something that we're keeping an eye on. We want to make sure that we have the best suite of assessments that we can for our based on our Minnesota standards. And so as we'll watch those, we can only work with what vendor we're going to have in the very end. So we'll keep our eyes on it, but it's obviously the vendor is going to make what test they want, and we need to work with our particular vendor to get what we need for Minnesota. I appreciate that comment.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning.
Good morning.
It's always nice to have you here, Mr. McHenry. I want you to talk to us a little bit more about the college entrance exam. I know some of us attended the meeting with Ms. Dugan when this was explained to us. But according to her statement then, this is going to be a shelf test. And the concern I raised was, how will this align with the standards that have been used and the benchmarks to which our students have been taught and tested for their results in prior grades? So would you comment on that? Or maybe I missed something when you said perhaps ACT is going to take over that?
Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, thank you for the question. For any test that we go through, whenever we develop a new test, we do have to go through a alignment and standard setting process to make sure we can use that test for federal accountability. In order to do that, we need to make sure the test is aligned to our state standards. And our benchmarks and our state standards. So whenever this contract is finalized and we have the test, we will go through the alignment and a standard-setting process to ensure that it is aligned with our state standards. Sometimes if there's tests that are not aligned specifically to the state standards, there could be some augmentation for a specific test. But we would have to have the final contract that specific tests go through that standard setting and alignment process.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that certainly contradicts what Ms. Dugan said, because she said it would be a shelf test. And that makes me concerned about math, because we have the most robust math standards in the nation. And in light of that, I'm not sure there's any shelf test that can match what we're doing in our classrooms. But that aside, what's the projected cost of all of this new testing that will kick in after 2015 or whenever?
Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I do want to say that although there can be off-the-shelf tests that are national, it doesn't prevent the fact that we still need to go through an alignment process and a standard-setting process. So that's something that can happen, but we do have to make sure that is aligned to our standards, even if it is an off-the-shelf test. For the specific cost, since we do not have the final budget, the final RFP signed, we don't have that final cost yet. We did, I'm going to have to maybe ask or step aside and get our specific budget costs, but there was an allocation in the bill last session that provided for the assessment contract. I have to get that specific number. What we're working under is the amount that we were given from the legislature last year. We based our estimates on how the contract would play out, what would have to be done for alignment, what would have to be done for standard setting, the amount of test, what the test would cost, and how many students would be taking the test. So we did make some assessments, or we did make some, there were some variables in there. I think at the end of session last year, the amount that we had estimated, we didn't receive that complete amount. But that being said, those numbers were specific estimates, and I think we'll know more information on the specific costs once we have this second RFP finalized.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, can Mr. Strom remind us of what amount was set aside in last year's budget? Thank you.
Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner McHenry, I'm sorry to put you on the spot. If Jennifer Dugan were here, I think she'd be maybe more able to address this. But it's a piggyback on Representative Erickson's question about the alignment issues. Mm-hmm. Because we have, so the suite of assessments, 8, 10, 11, if they were provided by a single vendor, we would have presumed an internal alignment. Now, there might be an alignment issue between those tests in terms of the college prediction factors and the career and college benchmarks that we're tracking 3-7. Now, I know we'll get alignment 3-7, 8-10, but what about that 10-11 alignment?
Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reinert, again, I think going back to the conversation we had before with Ms. Dugan, again, when you do have, let's say, an off-the-shelf product, they are going to have their tests done for who their clients have been before. So when we get that test and when we have a signed RFP, regardless of who it is, we do have to go through an alignment process. We can't take the vendor's word that it's aligned to the Minnesota standards. We can't take the vendor's word that it's aligned to the Common Core standards. And as Representative Erickson pointed out, our math standards are higher than the Common Core standards. So we do have to go through that process no matter what. We knew that in advance. I think we did talk about that last session, that regardless of when we change this test, we're going to have to go through that process. I think what we're looking at, or what we're trying to find out, is how, when we go through that alignment process, what type of augmentation may or may not have to happen based on what that test looks like. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further? Mr. McHenry, anything further?
Nothing further at this moment.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Melcher. Yeah. Please proceed and welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Tom Melcher. I'm the school finance director at the Department of Education, and I've got a short presentation here on some trends in school finance. Kind of in order to evaluate the trends, I've first outlined a couple of key elements of the state's role in education finance. I'll talk about those a little bit, and then we'll see how the trends are shaping up in terms of some of those goals or principles for school finance. So one of the things that most folks would agree on is that the state's school finance system should ensure that we have adequacy and equity for students. There are a lot of ways of defining that. I think the most common way of doing that is that the state should ensure that all local school districts have the resources that they need to provide an adequate basic education for all of their students, regardless of where they are in the state. And typically, the strategy for doing that includes two aspects. One is to provide an adequate basic formula that covers the cost of providing education to students without special needs, and then some additional funding for students that have special needs or for school districts that have unique circumstances, such as long distances to go for transportation. A second aspect of the state's role in education finance is to ensure that we have equity for taxpayers. And usually that is analyzed in terms of whether the tax burden to provide an adequate basic program is relatively uniform across all taxing jurisdictions, regardless of the local property tax base. In terms of funding the basic education formula, that can be handled with fully state funding the formula, as we have done since 2001, or with a uniform basic levy. We now have a small uniform basic levy. In addition to that, another aspect would be providing some equalization for the additional property tax levies that we ask school districts to make, and to try to index those so that the state share stays fairly constant as the tax base changes across the state. So those are a couple of basic principles: adequacy and equity for students, equity for taxpayers. So how are we doing? This chart shows the trend in general education revenue per student, excluding referendum and location equity. So basically the part that the state legislature is providing without having school districts go back to the voters. And what we can see here, the blue line is the unadjusted numbers. We've increased our general education funding from $6,130 to $7,800 per student on the average. If you adjust for inflation, there are a couple of ways you can do that. The red line shows the consumer price index adjusted numbers. The green line shows the numbers with the implicit price deflator. If you adjust for inflation using either of the two measures that are commonly used, we have lost ground since 2003. However, the silver lining here is if you look at the change between 2013 and 2015, we've kind of reversed that trend, and we have improved our situation by close to $200 per pupil over and above inflation during the last 2 years. So bottom line, we've lost some ground since 2003 within our general education program, but we're starting to make it up. How are we doing with special education funding? Well, for many years, we've been looking at something called the special education cross-subsidy, which is just a fancy way of saying, what's the unfunded cost of special education that school districts have to take out of their basic general education dollars to cover the cost? Back in 2003, the average cross subsidy was $447 per pupil unit or per ADM in school districts. Now it's $758 if we go out to 2000. So we have seen some increase in the cross subsidy for special education. That's had some ups and downs. The 2000 legislature made a strong effort to try to reduce that cross subsidy. You can see that it started to go down there a little bit. Also, we were blessed with some federal aid in the very lean years. There was the federal stimulus that you see in 2010 and 2011 helped reduce the cross subsidy. But then when that federal stimulus dried up, the cross subsidy went back up. But if you look at this trend here between 2012 and 2017, what you'll see is we're very stable. In fact, the cross-subsidy has come down by about $10 per student since 2012. And that's in part due to the additional resources that you provided during the 2013 session for special education funding. Another way of looking at the cross-subsidy for special education is what portion of the basic revenue for schools do they have to take off the top to cover the hole in their special education budgets? And you can see if we go all the way back to 2003, that was about 8% on the average. So you take 8% of your basic formula money to cover the unfunded special education cost. Again, there's been some ups and downs in that, related in part to the availability of federal stimulus dollars. But currently, we're at about 11.4%. So the typical district is taking 11% of their basic revenue to cover the unfunded cost in special ed, and that's been pretty stable over the last few years. What's happening to the state's share of education funding? Historically, we were in the 55 to 60% state aid range. That went up to an all-time high of 75%. In 2003, when we enacted the Ventura-era reforms, eliminating the state general education levy, we had a steady decrease from 2003 to 2010. We reached a low point of 62% state funding in 2010. And since then, we've seen a steady increase, and we're now up to 67% state share. You'll see there also in the green line is the federal funding, and we see that one-time bump up to 12% federal in 2010, and then that went right back down to about 7% federal. The next chart shows the state share of a couple of voter-approved types of levies. The blue line shows the referendum levy, and back in the early 2000s, we were funding 23-24% of referendum cost on the average. We saw a steady decline down to about 8% of referendums being covered by state aid in 2011. We began to see some increase between 2011 and 2014, primarily because of declining tax base with home values going down. And then as a result of the 2013 tax bill, where the equalization factor for Tier 1 of the referendum was increased to $880,000, we've seen a significant improvement there. We're now at 22.8%. state share on the average for school referendum levies, and that's very similar to where we were back in 2003. On the facilities side, the red line shows where we're at with debt service equalization. We declined from 6% state share down to about 1% in 2011. We've since seen a slight increase up to about 3%, but nearly all of the money for debt service is funded with local property taxes today. How are we doing in terms of equity? We have a measure in state statute that calls for the department annually to calculate the ratio of the 95th and 5th percentiles of basic and referendum revenue per student across the state. Back in the early 90s, we had a lawsuit. It was called Skeen versus State of Minnesota, where we had a number of low-wealth, low-revenue districts sue the state because of the big gap between the high and low-spending districts. Back at that time, the gap was 37%. So school districts at the 95th percentile had 37% more money to spend on each kid than districts at the 5th percentile. As a result of referendum equalization and caps that were put on referendums, that gap was reduced to 18.6% by 2003. But then as school districts relied more and more on referendums between 2003 and 2014, in part because the general education formula wasn't growing very rapidly during some of those lean years, the gap increased to 30%. So not quite as high as it was in 1992, but moving in that direction. And then that trend was reversed dramatically by the 2013 legislation as well. We're now back to 23.5%, and that is attributable to the changes in the tax bill that allowed school districts that could not pass a referendum to have a $300 per pupil referendum without voter approval, and also the provisions dealing with location equity that added another $212 per pupil to the districts over 2,000 students. So we can see some improvement in terms of how uniform the funding is across the state. What's the state's effort for education, or what's the tax burden? With this chart, it's from the cost of government report that MMB puts out. And what this shows is that we've had a decline in the tax burden for K-12 education as a percent of income. So historically, we were more in the 4.5% of income being used for state and local taxes for K-12 education. Now we're in the maybe 4.1% range. So our tax burden for education is lower than it was several years ago. Another development is the school shifts. We've paid them all back. As you know, this chart is taken from the November forecast document that MMB put out, and it provides a history. This slide is showing the aid payment shifts, and essentially what this is showing is that we shifted in 2002 and 2003 to the tune of about $600 million. We went down to an 80-20 at that point. We paid that back in 2005. And then in another set of lean years, in 2010 and 2011, we went from 90-10 down to 60-40, and we paid that back. So we are, as a result of the legislation you enacted in 2013, we did an early payback when the information in October showed that we were in a sound financial position. So the state aid shifts have been fully paid back. On the property tax shift side of things, again, we did do a tax shift in 2003, paid it back in 2006. We did another shift in 2010 session, and are now in the process of paying that back. We've officially announced that it's being paid back. The actual cash will go back to the districts in June of this year. So we're back at a 90-10 state aid payment schedule and no property tax shift. In addition to the PowerPoint, there's a chart in your handouts that I won't go through in detail, but it does show the complete history of the shifts going back to 1983, if you should be interested in additional history on that. So that is a quick update on school finance trends. I believe Denise Anderson is here. Is going to say a little bit about federal budget update.
Okay, so we'll have Ms. Anderson come down now, and then we'll take questions for Dr. Melcher or Ms. Anderson at that time. So. Ms. Anderson, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Denise Anderson, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Education. I don't have a lot of news today on the federal budget. We have not been officially notified yet of the funding levels that will come to the state of Minnesota. It appears from the general information that has been put out at the federal level, overall we'll see an increase of about 3% over our federal fiscal year 13 levels. And these increases are still slightly below the federal fiscal year 12 pre-sequestration levels. So, the increases have been from 0% up to 5% across the varying programs.
Any questions for Ms. Anderson? Or Representative Erickson. Ms. Anderson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, at the federal level now, we're talking special education has seen slight increases of about 4.5%.
And Mr. Chair, would you like me to ask my questions of Mr. Melcher? But now that you have.
No, we have a list for that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Woodard.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick question on the federal funding. Do you know what the percentage of that federal funding actually goes to schools versus to the state to administer the MDE?
I don't know that off the top of my head. Yeah. Off the top of my head, but I can get that information for you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Good. Any other questions for Ms. Anderson? If not, we'll take – thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll take questions for Dr. Melcher, and we have Representative Radenovich first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Dr. Melcher. I'm very encouraged by the trends that I see, of course, on the graphs that you've shown. You know, in particular, I come from a part of the state that as the state aid payments didn't keep up with inflation, we were left with a growing deficit between the cost of educating a kid and what resources were available to us. Naturally, when that happens, districts go out to levy, and I think we've seen the rise of levies over the last 10 to 15 years as a result of that. In addition to not keeping up with equalization, which is, you know, created unequal tax effort in order to go out and pass a levy, districts in my area contend with seasonal property as well. The 2001 Property Tax Reform Act took away about 48% of the referendum market value in my home district, about 40% in Aiken, and upwards of that in McGregor as well. I'm very encouraged by, in particular, the graph I see between the gap between the 5th and the 95th percentile of funding. Obviously, you know, when I was in high school, which wasn't that long ago, 2002, 2003, the gap was about 18%. Mm-hmm. It went up to 30% and then down to 23.5%, largely because of provisions, like you said, the $300 board-approved referendum. What steps would it take, how much more in resources would we have to give to continue to close that gap? I mean, did we pick the low-hanging fruit already, or, you know, are there some concrete measures that we could take to continue to reduce that gap?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I mean, we made a lot of progress in this last legislative session. So closing the gap involves a couple of policy issues. In the past, when we closed that gap, we had a tighter referendum cap, and those are not popular on the higher referendum districts. So that's kind of one policy issue. Do you want to tighten down on the high end, or do you want to try to do things to help the low end? You know, it's kind of, yeah. Do you level up or do you level down? So I think in the past we've tried to do as much leveling up as we can rather than restricting those at the high end, and to do more of the leveling up would probably require either a larger state investment in the equalization side, or allowing school boards more flexibility above and beyond that $300 level to raise referendum property taxes without voter approval. So there are some pluses and minuses the legislature would have to consider as they consider the issue of more discretionary levy authority for local school districts.
Thank you. I've got a follow-up.
Yes,
as well.
Representative Radenovich.
Thank you. I appreciate that answer, Dr. Melcher. And, you know, for everyone here, I think we're familiar with the group Schools for Equity in Education, and they came by last year with a great chart that sort of gave an example of the different effort it takes to pass a levy across the state prior to this mm-hmm. last legislative mm-hmm. session. Mm-hmm. And I believe if you were in most of the western suburbs, it was somewhere around $150 per $100,000 for the household to raise the maximum student levy. Mm-hmm. If you were in Royalton, Minnesota, I think it was $515 per $100,000 for the household to raise that maximum student levy. And so mm-hmm. you have understand, you know, very different circumstances throughout the state. And for those of us who represent rural districts of the state, I think that we can be very proud of the work that we've done here. Mm-hmm. My next question pertains to the state school local revenue as a percent of personal income, the graph there. And I noticed that generally there is a downward trend in that graph. Yeah. But there's a sharp spike somewhere around 2010, 2011. Mm-hmm. Now, my assumption, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that that wasn't a reflection of additional resources put into the state education. Rather, it was a reflection of the decline in personal income drastically through the recession. Is that correct?
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chair and Representative Radenovich, yes, that is correct. There was a sharp drop in personal income due to the recession at that time. State funding for education was rather flat at that point. In fact, there were some decreases that occurred because of the budget situation we had.
Thank you. And just one more follow-up.
Representative Radenovich.
Thank you. And, you know, I don't know if I've seen it, but it's been perhaps suggested to me that there's been a real decline in dollars put into education, you know, say in the last 10 or 15 years. Can you reference a point where, you know, either 10 or 15 years ago, and give us an idea of how much less of the state budget has been put into education in terms of real dollars? You know, I've heard perhaps that it's as much as $1 billion or more when compared to the Carlson administration.
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Radenovich, I did bring that data with me. The closest that I have here is just the general education portion of that on the slide, the third slide in my materials. What you can see here, depending on the inflation measure that you use, going from 6,130 down to 5,300. If you look at the more conservative measure, if we have, you know, roughly 800,000 pupil units in the state, if you look at, you can kind of do the math there and get a get to that kind of a number. But certainly, if you would like, we could go back and do something more comprehensive, but we'll look at all of the education funding.
Thank you. Representative Chair,
yes, and thank you, Dr. Melcher. I certainly appreciate all the work you've done. This information has been very valuable for me, and I'm proud of the work that we've done here on this committee to reduce that gap out in greater Minnesota. Thank you.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perfect timing. Dr. Melcher, kind of piggybacking on Representative Radinovich's last question, could you toggle back in the presentation, please, to the slide on the price of government that you had up there, the measurement as a percentage? There it is. Thank you very much. State and local revenue as a percentage of personal income. I think this is particularly telling myself. I think it's great to measure versus inflation. I think that gives us one sense of where we are in funding. I think this is important, though, because to me, at least, this is a measure of how much of our state's treasure, how much of our personal wealth and income we as a state and local governments are willing to invest in our future, in our students. And, you know, when you look at that, it doesn't seem like all that much, right? When you go from 4.55 to 4.12, that seems like a very small amount. But my understanding is the projections for next year is that the personal income in the state of Minnesota from the forecast is going to be in the neighborhood of $270 billion. When you take about a half a percent or a little less than a half a percent of that, we are talking about more than $1 billion behind. And so I guess I'm making more of a comment than asking a question. Well, I did appreciate Dr. Melcher putting that back up there again, but I think that's significant. And while it shows we have perhaps leveled off the downward trend of recent years, we haven't quite turned that back up again. So I thank you very much, Dr. Melcher, for your work here, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, I have a question from Mr. Heller here, who would like to know which graph represents the shift in maintenance of effort. Do you have an answer to that?
Dr. Melcher.
I don't have a graph that specifically relates to maintenance of effort. Normally, we think of maintenance of effort in terms of federal funding, and the federal government requires that we maintain our effort for special education in order to qualify for federal special education aid. And we have done that each year. In fact, our funding mechanism is set up so that we have about a 4% increase in the state aid for special education each year. So there are a number of ways of measuring effort, but the one that you most commonly hear in terms of maintenance of effort is the federal requirement that we maintain effort. This is another kind of measure of effort. What's our tax effort for education? And certainly we can see that while the actual dollars we're spending are going up, the dollars as a percentage of our tax base or our wealth is going down.
Thank you. And maybe Mr. Heller, and you could talk later. He has another question, too, I think, of Ms. Anderson. But my question, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, maybe it's not a question. It's a comment, too, following what was said by Representative Radinovich and Representative Morgan. You know, we have to keep in mind that small businesses and our small communities, because we don't all live in the suburbs. I live in very questionable areas. I have issues with Lake Mille Lacs right now, and if that lake is managed differently, I'm going to have a lot of businesses that die around that lake. And so when I show small business people these graphs, and they see, you know, what we've been doing for our students, which they're very happy to see, they also remind me that we didn't have those kinds of increases during the recession, and we're still climbing out of a very tough time. And so we have to keep in mind that at home, we have a situation whereby we are taking a lot in C&I, for example, from our small businesses. Now they're facing perhaps a minimum wage increase. And I tell you, they're really nervous out there, and they're really concerned. And they want the best education possible in Minnesota. But at the same time, they want us to be realistic and remember that the money comes from them. And in small communities, such as I represent, the money can only go so far. They're tax dollars when there are levies. And, you know, for the most part in my community, we pass all the levies. But at the same time, we have to remember this is a trade-off. So, you know, let's always keep in mind that the money comes from somebody. And those are small business owners. And I think they are affected in rural Minnesota very much. So when we see this gap on the chart that shows the general education revenue per student, and as you noted, Dr. Melcher, you know, there is that, and now we're making it up, but there was that gap. Well, that was indicative of the economic times we had. So, you know, we can't be blaming somebody because we had an economy that fell. And now it's rising. And furthermore, we have tax increases on many of our folks that are going to account for this difference. So remember, we took so that we could do. Thank you.
Going in the practice of the tax committee, which I serve on, is when someone's a member is named in a comment, I'm going to allow them to respond. Representative Radenovich.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to do that. And I appreciate Representative Erickson's comments. You know, but what I would suggest is that the decline in exasperation, the growth in the gap between the 5th and 95th percentile of funding didn't just happen over the course of the recession. In fact, it's been happening for over a decade. And so I think it reflects a trend where in 8 of the last 10 years, while facing budget deficits, we didn't respond with the necessary actions to protect, I think, the most valuable mission of the state, which is to educate our children. And while we might see over the course of a recession a dip in revenues impacting our schools' ability to perform, we also have to keep in mind that these children are children. They don't have a second opportunity at the first grade, the second grade, the third grade, the fourth grade. They get one shot. And so I think that, you know, when considering the budget deficits we've faced, that we ought to remember that these children only get one chance at school. I would also say that the districts that I represent have in excess of 60 to 70% of the students on free or reduced lunch. And I'm not going to drag this into a debate on the minimum wage, but I should say that the practice whereby we've neglected equalization has come at the expense of those districts who are most economically distressed, I would say. So they have a reduced tax base. They haven't kept up with equalization, and they've seen the brunt of that. And so in my district, in Crosby-Ironton, that's meant that we've cut half of our shop classes. It's meant that we've cut all the gifted and enriched programming for junior high and elementary students. It meant that last year they had baseball and softball on the chopping block. And so my disagreement here is not with you know, making tough decisions, but I think the wrong decisions were made when we were looking at that situation. And you know, if I would say one more thing, it's that the tax bill that we passed last year raised its income primarily from those making in excess of $250,000 a year. And I'm not somebody who would demonize the rich for their success, but what I would say is that you know, we have areas of the state where that type of success is not prevalent. In fact, there's less than 1 in 100 taxpayers in my district who make in excess of $250,000 a year. And so I think asking someone who's paying are making $250,000 or $260,000 a year to pay an additional $200 in state taxes is not an undue burden to make sure that we can educate to an equal level the students across the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question for Dr. Melcher, but the current discussion about GAP, the district I live in is in the bottom 1% of funding. Blue Ribbon High School, nationally recognized. It has the won the Intel Math Award, another national recognition. And frequently, we focus so much on the dollars that we should be focusing on where it's going and how effective it is. Because, frankly, the flavor of the year or the month in education may get a lot of dollars. But it's the kids in the district. So when I see that chart of the gap, you know, frankly, with my district I live in, that gap, last time I calculated, between it and the larger school districts that we have, basically is 56, 58%. I mean, it's, you know, if we had even a fraction of that, there are wonderful things we can do, but then I stop and I look, we are doing wonderful things. And frankly, we got to look at what's successful and focus on that and stop looking at the dollar sign. We have to look at results and what's helping our kids. Now on to the question for Dr. Melcher is, when you were presenting, I've got it as slide 59, and talking about the school shift, you had made a comment, and I need some clarification because it seemed to be a little bit, I had concerns about the precision and accuracy when you stated that the, you know, we had a shift in the budget in the, you know, 2011-2012, and that was paid back with the 2013. I sat here in committee, and when the budget, education budget we voted and passed out of committee, had a thing called savings, which was an increase in the shift. It was in the about $70 million range, but I think the accurate, more precise way to refer to how this got paid back is that once you fill the cash flow account, once you fill the reserve account, that all surpluses in revenue go to pay back the school shifts that were in there, and in fact, that which is totally outside of the budget we vote on. You know, on here you've got November 2012, you know, over $1 billion. So the vast majority of that shift was paid back before the budget that you credited was even debated here. And that, in fact, the reason why the shift was paid back is because of surpluses in regards to what the budget was, and we had already refilled both the cash flow and the cash reserves. So that's why, you know, I felt that your comment needed clarification and precision as to what actually did pay back the school shifts. So can you clarify, please?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Quam, you're exactly right. The state policy, long established, is that we fill up those state cash flow reserve accounts first, and then the next priority is to repay the shifts. And that's exactly what happened. And the primary thing driving that is the improving state economy. I think the one point that I was trying to make, the very last entry here is the October 2013 close payback. That there was a piece in the legislation that occurred in the 2013 session which caused that to be accelerated a little bit ahead of the usual schedule, because what it said was that if there is a surplus at the end of the 2013 fiscal year, then we'll pay back early in October instead of waiting for that usual process to occur in the November forecast. So it accelerated the payback some as a result of that legislation that was in the budget bill last year. But the payback would have occurred anyway. It just would have been a little bit later. And in fact, only a few months later. So I appreciate your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the clarification on that.
Thank you. I have Representative Grunhagen, Representative Woodard, Representative Dabney, and then we're going to move to the next bill. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be careful not to mention any other reps' names. I do not want my comments refuted by anybody in the room. Okay. Especially Representative Anzalek.
Oh, there you go.
I'm sorry. Strike that comment.
Get
from the
ready,
record.
Representative Anzalek. You'll have the note.
Do you want to say something before or after I talk, Representative?
Depends upon what you're going to say.
Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you for your presentation, Dr. Melchert. And I always find them to be very informative and insightful. Okay. Just a couple of comments in response. First, on the inflation graph, it's important to understand that our families and businesses have had that same effect on their incomes and their family budgets as the school districts have. Okay, and secondly, I would just say that. And a lot of what Representative Erickson said is I will try to avoid repeating again. But back to the personal income gap, okay? One of the things we know nationally is that with the Federal Reserve creating fiat money to the tune of about $85 billion a month, puffing up our stock market, okay, and now they've reduced that a little bit in recent months, that the wealthy have done very well. In fact, according to one national graph, wealthy's income since, I believe it's 2009, I have the statistics back in my office, have gone up about 30%, okay? But the middle class have only gone up about 0.5%, and the lower income have basically seen zero increase in their purchasing ability. So I think this personal income graph is skewed by the what I would call corrupt policies of our Federal Reserve, which have favored the wealthy over the middle class and the low income. In fact, we actually see a reduced number of middle class in our country nationwide, and more low income, which is reflected in the sign up for more and more services. So I would submit to you this, that we needed it, if we need additional tax revenues, which I want to fund the schools properly, okay, and I want the teachers to be paid a good salary for the jobs that they do, so we can draw people in that are of the best quality. The question is, how do we do that? Well, I believe we need to, number one, not penalize the wealthy in this state, but incentivize them to invest in the state of Minnesota, create new jobs and businesses, and as we grow the economy, it will generate billions of dollars in new tax revenue, which we see in North Dakota on a regular basis. Which brings me to the next point, is we need to streamline our permit process, start mining and drilling in this country, or mining in this state, which, by the way, we're one of the richest in the nation, okay, the richest in the nation, and we can have a booming economy that will pay everybody more than the minimum wage, regardless of what we set it at, and we will see billions of dollars in new tax revenue to meet the needs that we need here at the state of our most vulnerable education system. We also need to maximize the income off our school trust property, okay? That will, and that's got billions of dollars of assets that we can get a percentage from to help our school districts. So rather than penalizing the rich with higher taxes and regulations and incentivizing them to invest outside the state or move outside the state, we need to do just the opposite. Incentivize them to come to the invest in Minnesota, reduce the penalty for, or incentivize creating new businesses and jobs, and streamline our permit process for mining so that we can do it in an environmentally friendly way that will benefit all of our society, not just increase the taxes, which is the easiest solution to almost any problem. Well, increase taxes. Well, in the end, you're going to get less revenue as you punish the private sector for success. Those are just my comments.
Thank you. Now, Representative Grunhagen, I've got to have Janet Yellen, the chair of the Federal Reserve, come before the board here. And that might cost the committee some money, so I
well,
wish you...
wait for her. Okay,
all right. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's an honor to serve on the tax committee. We can debate these issues. I appreciate that.
Nicely done.
Yeah. First of all, I do want to thank those people who dig the holes and cut the trees that help fund our school system. I won't mention the representative who typically makes that comment, but I will like to thank those folks for doing that. And then, Dr. Melcher, just a very specific question quickly here. You've got a slide here on general education revenue per student. And you said it excluded referendum and location equity revenue. And I know the folks back home are often confused by all this language because we sometimes use the basic, we call it the basic education. We do all kinds of things. What would this look like if we added in, you know, everything, integration aid, compensatory revenue, or does this chart already include those things? Can you kind of clarify what it includes and doesn't?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Woodard, this does include compensatory revenue. It's everything in the general education program except referendum and location equity. So historically, this chart was attempting to show what the legislature provides funding for as opposed to what local school districts go and get approved by the voters. That concept is getting a little bit blurred now that we have location equity, which is not voter approved in a portion of the referendum. But I was trying to, in order to provide the historical context, provide those same components. So it does include basic formula, equity revenue, compensatory, ELL funding, sparsity, transportation sparsity, everything except that referendum and now the location equity, just so it's comparable.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Final question, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I actually do serve on the Tax Committee.
You don't have to go today.
So apparently I'm getting a hall pass from Representative Woodard today. I just listening to the debate, I think we've wandered into a bit of a false dichotomy as it comes to funding our schools. And I'm reminded of a couple of years ago being out in school district ISD 196, Rosemont, Apple Valley, Egan. Thank you, Representative Morgan. And, well, we'll just say I was talking with voters. And I went to the door, and there was a man that answered the door. And I could see behind him his two daughters looked to be upper elementary, middle school, and working on playing on some laptops. It was a Saturday. And we got talking about education, and he identified it as a priority. And I shared with him how his school district, because of the school shift, had to go out to borrow money just to make cash flow, just to pay the bills. And he said, I know, it's nuts. He said, they can't afford enough textbooks in the classes. I had to go out and buy laptops for my daughters so they could do their homework. And I looked at him and said, how's that whole no new taxes thing working for you? And he looked back at me and said, it's not. We get into a false dichotomy that if we just keep taxes low, everything is good. But in fact, what this family had experienced was higher costs because this legislature was not adequately funding its schools. And they experienced a direct burden of having to go out and buy expensive technology because the school district wasn't able to meet the basic needs of the students. And so I just think we have to be careful that we get into these false dichotomies when, in fact, adequately funding our schools not only provides business with the type of workers they need, the world's best workforce, as you focused on, opportunities for students to be engaged, but also does it in a way where the community takes responsibility to make sure that all of its kids can get there in a way that's affordable and accessible for all families. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, Dr. Melcher, thank you so much. And I know last year when you had the finance reform group, they're looking at all sorts of things, you had these very same charts out and in that committee. And I know when you came before our committee last year early on, you had these same graphs and charts. And I think it's excellent news that in a lot of these key indicators, you know, the dollars in comparison to education, to inflation is going up. The percent of state share in referendum going up, which is going to help the equity. And I thought, as Representative Radenovich mentioned, the graph that shows the narrowing of that disparity between the wealthy, or kind of the high revenue, low revenue, was very remarkable. And, you know, one of the things you mentioned was that $300 on the first referendum. And just for, you know, folks in rural Minnesota, there were 37 school districts, I believe, that had zero referendum. 37. And every single one of them was from rural Minnesota. And that helped bring that up. And so it's still somewhat, unfortunately, by zip code. You know, we still have to narrow that gap, but it's very encouraging to see these stats and seeing that we narrowed that gap some. And so any final comments or anything, Dr. Melcher?
I would say that I think it's sometimes helpful to step back and take a look at the long-term trends, and I think that the results are very positive, that we have reversed some trends, and we're showing some significant improvements. So I want to thank you for that as far as the improvements we're seeing in our school funding system.
Thank you for your great work. Thank you much. At this time, we are going to hear some very important bills for our children and for our state. And so, Representative Selzer, if you would come forward. Representative Selzer, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would, Chair Marquardt. First, I'd like to move an amendment, if that's all right.
Move your bill first.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, you did. Okay. Yes. Yep. All right. Representative Selzer has moved the House File 2480.
Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you.
And now you'd like to move your amendment.
Yes, I would. Thank you.
So we've got the A2 amendment, and this is the put it in the form you'd like.
Yes, I'd like to move the A2 amendment, Chair Marquardt.
Would you say just what it does there, Representative Selzer?
Certainly. It brings the fiscal note in compliance, the fiscal piece of my bill in compliance with the fiscal note that was just issued as to what the cost of this would be.
Okay. Very good. Any comment? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Clarification, we're moving to where with this bill?
We are here. Okay, members, here's what we're going to do with this. There are two bills that we're going to hear today. We're going to hear both of those bills and then lay both of those bills over. And then we're going to bring back House File 2480. And then the motion will be to refer that to Ways and Means Committee. Representative Baum. So we're going to hear both bills and then come back and pull one off the table and consider referring that to Ways and Means. Yes?
Mr. Chair, do we get to suggest which one we pull off the table?
This is an open committee, of course. Democracy reigns, Representative Quam. Anyway, any further debate on the A2 amendment? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The amendment does prevail. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay. Representative Selzer, would you like to speak to your bill?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today, I'm very excited to present this bill. This is a concept that had bipartisan support in the last legislative session. And today we have the opportunity to help our working poor by ensuring that their children get at least two nutritious meals during the school day. Some children today in Minnesota are not. As you know, in 2003, under Governor Pawlenty, Minnesota eliminated the 30-cent fee collected for reduced-priced breakfast, which helped to increase access to and participation in one of the most important meals of the day. Our governor and legislature at that time had the wisdom to look at the federal poverty guidelines and realize the budget crunch that families who qualified for the reduced meal rate were facing. As we all know, prices have climbed since then, especially for those foods we would put in the nutritious category. My bill would eliminate the 40-cent per lunch fee to those who qualify for reduced lunch, and this would enable us to partner with school districts and provide them with the funds and the clear direction that these students need to receive the standard nutritious hot lunch based on the new upgraded federal guidelines. Some folks have expressed the feeling that children whose families fall into this category, they're above the federal poverty guidelines, but below 185% of the federal poverty guideline, and they should pay something towards these lunches, a good faith effort, as it were. But let's just take a moment and examine a family of three, say a mom and two children, earning $32,412 a year, which places them at about 166% of the federal poverty guidelines, making them eligible for the reduced price lunch. This family has about a $2,701 month income in the metro area. At this income level, the family is not eligible for assistance or SNAP. Or a reasonable monthly budget for this family in the metro, not including clothing or some other basic necessities that you and I could name, would be perhaps $1,100 for housing and utilities, maybe $350 a month for employer-subsidized health and dental care for three, $450 a month for transportation, including maybe a car payment, insurance, and gas, $750 a month for before and after school care if you look at 3.5 hours a day for two children. That leaves about $51 a month for food unless you drop some of the above expenses. Now, you could say these expenses might be fungible. Perhaps there is no monthly car payment, but then you're probably dealing with an older car. There will be repairs. And children need clothing, which is not included in this budget, and there are other expenses that you and I could name in raising a child. You know, and if there is a large car repair bill, this may be the month mom or dad just don't pay the reduced lunch fee as they're trying to make ends meet. A child who has decided not to have lunch because he or she knows that mom or dad hasn't paid this month's lunch bill is more likely to go home and overeat on the starchier foods that the family can afford. This child is less likely to do well academically in school, so as we know that good nutrition plays a huge role in learning. And as Chair Marquardt mentioned in our first meeting this session, closing the achievement gap is a goal that we've all agreed on in this committee. Through this bill, we are helping financially challenged families, and we're working towards one of the main goals of this committee. So this is a great opportunity to, in a bipartisan manner, make the statement that no child shall go hungry in Minnesota because of an inability to pay. Thank you, Chair Marquardt.
Thank you, Representative Seltzer. At this time, I'd like to have Representative Wills come to the table. She has introduced House File 2630. It's not on the agenda, but I'd like her to speak to that. It's an identical bill to House File 2480, so if Representative Wills, you would.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. And I first want to start out by saying thank you to Representative Seltzer for introducing this legislation, and I thought it was something that I wanted to support as well, so I introduced identical legislation. It's House File 2630, and I think Representative Seltzer did a good job outlining what the bill does, and just wanted to add some reinforcement to why this bill is important. We heard testimony last session when we heard Representative Newton's bill with a similar initiative, and the testimony was very, very compelling on how important it is that children get a good meal so they can focus on their studies, and when a child is hungry, they have difficulty learning, and we want to make sure that we're closing that achievement gap. So I wanted to pass around a handout. I think I might have gotten passed around an article that just highlights that the challenge that we're seeing in our state. And granted, I'm sure this is an exception, not a rule, but there are situations in our state where children are being bullied because they are either given a sticker to wear because they weren't able to pay for their lunch, and so this story highlights that in Stuartville, Minnesota. And there's also situations of meals being dumped in the garbage and we're wasting food. Again, I want to emphasize that I believe this is an exception, not a rule, but it's something that should never happen. And so I believe that this legislation would address that concern. So another point I wanted to make out is that we did have an opportunity to address this last session. I would have liked to have seen Representative Newton's bill included in our omnibus bill. We also had another opportunity on the House floor when Representative McDonald offered an amendment to fund these school lunches. And I supported that amendment, and unfortunately it was defeated. And so I'm glad that we have the opportunity today to readdress this issue, and hopefully we can make sure this legislation passes this session. So with that, I stand for questions. Well,
thank you very much. What we're going to do now is take testimony. And so we've got Ms. Keith first. Thank you. And so let's see if we've got more chairs that we can bring in here. And if I could ask testifiers to stay right on the point, then thank you.
Yes. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Elaine Keefe. I represent the Minnesota School Nutrition Association. Our association is made up of school nutrition directors, dietitians, cooks, and cafeteria servers. Our members work very hard to provide healthy school meals to Minnesota's children. We strongly support this bill to provide free school lunch to all low-income children by eliminating the 40-cent fee currently paid by families for a reduced-price lunch. Our legislative issue paper is in your packets. It looks like this. And we think that making reduced price lunch free is so important that it is the only issue on our issue paper. And that's the first time we have ever devoted the entire issue paper to a single issue. We worked very hard this fall to convince Governor Dayton to include funding for this in his budget, and we were delighted when he announced that he would do so. There are many good reasons to support this bill. You've heard a number of them. For a relatively small cost of $3.5 million a year, you can lift a real burden from working families and ensure that their children have daily access to a healthy school meal. Eliminating the fee for reduced price lunch will also help close the achievement gap. Research shows that children who regularly participate in school meal programs have better physical and mental health, they have higher academic performance, and they demonstrate better behavior than children who do not participate. We expect that if reduced price lunches become free, more students in this category will eat school lunch. That's a benefit to them. And also, it will give us more economies of scale, which will help the financial stability of school lunch programs. Finally, Minnesota has a national reputation for being a trailblazer, both in education and in providing outstanding school nutrition programs. This school year, Vermont became the first state in the nation to make school lunch free for all low-income children by eliminating the 40-cent fee for reduced price lunch. And we think if Vermont can do it, Minnesota ought to be able to do it too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Quickly, Representative Baum.
Mr. Chair. Ms. Keith, your second item, do you have data on the achievement gap by free lunch population, reduced lunch, and then the general? Because you're making the comment. And then also, my opinion is that this applies to children, whether they're free, reduced, or full pay lunches. It's independent of that, and that I just wanted to see if you've got data show it's not independent, that actually the achievement gap tracks not household but tracks whether they're on that program or not.
Ms. Keefe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam. The data that I have seen just looks at whether students participate regularly in the school meals program or not, regardless of whether they are in the full pay category, reduced price category, or free category. But our assumption is that, well, in fact, we know that when we eliminated the fee for reduced price breakfast, we saw participation go up. I know that this year in Vermont, when they eliminated the fee for reduced price lunch, they saw participation go up. And so I think we assume that that will happen here as well. And when more of those children participate, they will reap the benefits.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Next.
Yeah.
Please state your name for the committee, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. And I first want to thank Representative Seltzer and Representative Wills, and also Representative Jerry Newton, who really was an original champion on this even 6 years ago. And also almost every member of this committee who I've met with this year and last year, and I know that you understand this issue and you care deeply about it, and I really appreciate that you are taking this up. So I'm here to represent Legal Aid. We represent low-income families statewide, and so my primary concern is assuring that the state's lowest-income children are always guaranteed a hot meal, no matter what their district-income children are always guaranteed a hot meal, no matter what their district's policy or practices. So in that vein, I really do support Representative Seltzer's bill and Representative Will's kind of direction of funding these children's lunch first. I remain deeply concerned about the hand stamping, the stickers on chests. I'm concerned about all of those things. And as you know, I think the report's being handed out now. A lot of you have seen our report that we issued last month about this. I'm not going to talk about the report, but I want to tell you a few things that have happened in the wake of that report that have given us kind of pause and optimism. One is that this has become a very public conversation. Legal Aid and Mazzone and other advocates have been talking about this for a long time, but this is the first time this year that we have seen parents talking about it, school boards, superintendents really paying attention to the issue. We've seen districts, a half dozen districts, change their policies and practices already in the last 4 weeks. I think that this child that had a sticker put on their chest, those parents advocated immediately. They contacted the press. There was stories about it. People were horrified. These things have been happening for a while, and now people are paying attention. And I am really heartened that school districts and superintendents will start to revisit some of these practices and change some of these practices. And I think parents will advocate with their local school districts. The second thing I wanted to say, we've seen, and there's press attached to our report, is that we've seen not only parents of school children, but citizens step forward and offer money to local school districts for angel accounts. And I've never thought that an angel account can kind of solve the breadth of this problem. But I do think if we guarantee a hot meal to the lowest income children, these children that are at 186% to maybe 225 or 250% of poverty, that is a good population for some of these angel accounts. And districts, many districts have angel accounts. We noted, you know, about 100 districts statewide that are feeding children the hot meal of the day. And as citizens start to kind of step forward and help fund these angel accounts and PTAs make this a priority, we think there will be some funds, additional funds for these children that are kind of just over the line, and that there won't be such a harsh cliff anymore for these children that have had trays pulled and lunches dumped. So thank you again very much for your time and for taking up this issue. Really, really appreciate it this year. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have two amendments yet, and I know there's some debate, so I'm not going to allow for any questions right now of any of the testifiers. So next, please. Please state your name for the committee, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Rabbi Harold Kravitz. I'm a rabbi at Adath Yeshurun congregation in Minnetonka. And I also serve as chair of a national Jewish anti-hunger group called Mazon, a Jewish response to hunger, which supports about 300 anti-hunger organizations in the U.S. primarily, and Israel, and many of the really wonderful organizations in Minnesota that do anti-hunger work. We're inspired by the commandments in the book of Leviticus calling on us to recognize our obligation to make sure that those who are in need are provided for. And the book of Ruth, which is a powerful example of a family in need who was able to benefit from a society that was structured in that way. 7 years ago at our synagogue, we organized an a hunger summit for Minnesota that Mazon organized. And it was at that meeting that Jessica heard one of the state nutritionists talking about this problem of pulling trays that is so horrifying to all of us, as we've heard about in Utah, where 40 kids' trays were pulled at one time. And certainly that created a sense of outrage and shock in Minnesota when people heard, you know what, that's been going on here. Jessica's been working on this issue for the last 7 years. We've been supporting that effort, supporting Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid, which is one of our grantees, around and in her research on policies and practices in schools around how to deal with kids when their parents are unable to pay. We've organized a coalition in Minnesota, which is on a sheet that I believe you received, that describes our kind of one-page description. On the back is the coalition, and we appreciate that many of those people are here today. It's interfaith, it's anti-hunger groups, it's hospitals, it's farmers, it's unions, support SIEU, who represent the school lunch employees. So we really appreciate people's sense of outrage. That's not the kind of state we want. That's not the kind of country we want. We are heartened by all the support of the governor and what seems to be a growing, broad, bipartisan support in the legislature following the release of Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid's study. And we also hope that schools will continue to do soul-searching on turn-away policies as well. We have postcards, which I'd ask the page if they could distribute, that we are delivering to many legislators that are signed by your constituents. Mazon and our project, Mazon Advocacy Project Minnesota, last year worked with in the House with Representative Ryan Winkler, and again this year with Representative Yvonne Seltzer on this bill, HF 2480, for asking the state to pay the 40-cent copay for students on reduced-priced lunch so that none of these students will go hungry or face the stigma or shame either of getting no lunch or of an alternate lunch that calls attention to their difficult situation, and we hope for your support this year. We'd also like to comment on the bill
Rabbi Kravitz, could you just really,
really quickly,
short of time.
We understand that Representative Sarah Anderson is also bringing a bill, and we particularly, you know, there's challenges around that, but we do appreciate the concern about the stigma of this issue. Finally, I want to just acknowledge Representative Newton, who had this bill last year, Representative Will, who's bringing it again, and all the co-sponsors, and we hope that this support will lead to passage this session. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next testifier, please. And I ask if you can just be very, very short here, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Please state your name.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Gigi Chawla. I'm a pediatrician at Children's and the Senior Medical Director of Primary Care. Last year, Children's Hospitals and Clinics saw and treated 125,000 patients statewide and 300,000 patients in our metro area clinics. We are privileged to serve a very diverse population across these clinics, from suburban populations and primarily insured to inner city English as a second language patients on two-thirds on Medicaid. Regardless of income, social strata, language, culture, inner city or suburb, children have the same needs in order to become successful learners. They simply cannot concentrate to learn if they are hungry. Their behavior changes in the classroom, making it more challenging for teachers if they are hungry. In clinic, I see children every day that don't know where their next meal is coming from. Last week, I saw an 8-year-old overweight boy in whom I was addressing his nutritional plan and status. I asked him what he had for breakfast and lunch, and he described two very well-balanced meals that were from school. I did ask him next what he had for dinner, and I could noticeably watch his mother squirm as he mentioned, "Oh, we don't have enough money for dinner. I just usually eat a bag of chips for dinner, but my mom always makes sure that I eat my vegetables and fruit from the school lunch." So you see, families not only count on school meals to ensure that their children can concentrate and learn, but also these meals represent, for some children, their primary source of nutrition. On a personal note, I live in District 1A and have two teenage daughters. Once when my 6-year-old came home from school at that time, she said, you know, that she had eaten a cheese sandwich for lunch and that I had forgotten to pay for school meals. I was immediately mortified and embarrassed and upset that the school hadn't notified me. But she mentioned to me that the school actually had notified me on my old email accounts. Luckily for me, I had the finances to be able to pay that bill online. I had the technology to be able to do it from my own home. And I could read those emails, which were my oversight, that were written in English. Overall, you know, I used that moment to talk to my own children about social stigma and how parents are not 100% perfect every time. But kids have a way of making sure that they teach you something at the time that you're trying to teach them something. And she mentioned to me that, you know, the best part of a cheese sandwich is that you realize who your real friends are, because your real friends share part of their lunch with you so you don't go hungry. Today, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd like you all to consider that the state of Minnesota should be every child's real friend to make sure that no child goes hungry. Thank you.
Thank you. And, Doctor, did you travel all the way down from District 1A today? Or?
No.
Oh,
no.
Okay. Thank you. It's quite a trip. So, thank you very much. Any other testifiers that would care to testify for or against this bill? Okay. Thank you all, testifiers. And so we have two amendments here. And we're going to go to the A9 amendment. Is anyone offering the A9 amendment? Representative McDonald.
Yeah, Chairman, I'm offering the A9 amendment.
Very
would
good.
Would you like me to read it, what the amendment does?
Well, yeah, just tell us what it does, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Seltzer, thank you for this bill. Your bill, very important issue. We sat here a year ago and were privy to the testimony, and Representative Newton brought the bill It's been repeated. It was a very important issue. And I think we're all disappointed, especially you, Representative Newton, since you were the author of the bill, that it wasn't incorporated in the omnibus bill. Representative Seltzer, you said in your opening statement that today we have the opportunity to help our children get a nutritious meal. And I wish that was true. But with your bill, we wait till next year, when last year we had an opportunity to take care of this. So I hope that you'll be accepting of my amendment and see that, similar to the heating issue with the propane, lack of propane, we made it an emergency. And as a Senate and a House, we got it done right away. It became a bill as an assisting people today that need it, not tomorrow and not next year. So my amendment simply takes the money from the climate centers that has not yet been built but been budgeted for last year, takes $1 million, and puts it in your bill today, Representative Seltzer, so the money can be used in our school districts in fiscal year 14, so it can get to the children today, not tomorrow. Representative Marquardt, our number one priority was to close the achievement gap, and I think that your bill, omnibus bill, did some of that. But in reading some of this documentary, some of the information from our testifiers, each one of them not only says it's a relatively small amount. I tell you, folks, if we start thinking $3.5 million is a relatively small amount, we got to have our head examined. No offense to those who wrote this in these papers, because I know you're doing good work. But $3.5 million, folks, is not a small amount, especially when it's annually. So, and also in your document, it's very vital to closing the achievement gap. And you're right, no kid should go hungry. But it's going to happen if this amendment isn't accepted, because my amendment, gets the money today. So I hope that you'll be subject and open your hearts and not think this is political theater, because certainly this happens at this Capitol, both on both sides. It's pretty disheartening that we have to play this, political theater. But this is a good amendment. It gets the money to the school kids today, and I hope that you'll accept the amendment.
Representative Radenovich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My good friend, Representative McDonald, referenced a political theater. As the author of the propane bill, which passed on the first day of session, and made an emergency appropriation of $20 million to those families who most need it, I would like to point out that that money didn't come from the Department of Commerce. It came from the general fund and the $1.23 billion surplus that we were projected to have. And so what I would say is that, I think everybody on this committee values and understands how important it is to provide these students with lunches at 40 cents. But I guess, what I would say is that in light of the surplus that, we worked hard to build up and to, value priorities like this, that we don't need to take this money from the Minnesota Department of Education so that we undercut our efforts to account for success in our schools and to make sure that we can, going forward, have the high quality that we do. So again, I support wholeheartedly that we make this decision to support these schools. But as with the propane bill, I don't think that we need to, play political theater and take it from a department, but instead we can pass it out of our general fund budget.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd thank you, Representative Radenovich, for your comments. That doesn't allow you to rebut mine. But I would like to speak in opposition to the amendment as well. What this does is it pits kids who are being bullied and services needed for them against kids who are hungry. And Ms. Webster, when she came up and spoke, raised concerns about the ongoing impact of kids having stickers placed on them, hand stamps, things like that. We close the achievement gap in many different ways. Dealing with kids who are hungry and being denied lunches is one. Building stronger school climates to have more positive school experiences for everyone is another. As Representative Radenovich said, at a time of surplus, I don't think we need to pit vulnerable children against vulnerable children. Representative Will's article that she passed out about the incident in Stewartville is an example. I think we can build strong schools and resources for our schools for better opportunities for our kids. Thank you.
And final, Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this is $1 million that is sitting in a vault in St. Paul. And this is money that could be used today to help solve this problem today. I wish we would have passed it last year. And I appreciate the comments that we have a $1.2 billion surplus. So I hope members will remember that on the House floor today. If you honestly believe that $1 billion is being underfunded in our schools today, then I assume you're not going to vote for the tax cut bill that's coming up on the House floor today. If you honestly believe that, there is $1.2 billion surplus, and what we're asking for here is $1 million to fix this today. So, you know, you're talking out of both sides of your mouth if you believe that this is honestly important. If there's a $1.2 billion surplus, you will find the money. This is an effort to find the money that we know is sitting in a vault here in St. Paul that can be used. And I certainly hope that we will use this opportunity to take care of this today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And members, the budget resolution specifically lists $3.5 million. I mean, there's only three things mentioned: what we're going to tax as far as cuts, what we're going to spend, and then this $3.5 million for the school nutrition program. So I think it's been made a priority. So I'm going to call for the vote on Amendment A9. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay.
No.
Motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Another amendment, we have the A11 amendment. Who would like to offer that? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I offer the A11 amendment. In the testimony, we've heard many compelling things, and frequently threaded in that is every child, every child. And I see a weakness in this bill in that, and a year ago I offered the same compromise approach. The weakness is that you're just saying the children that are in the free and reduced, and there's, in many of our districts, there was recently in the paper a layoff, a cutting of employees at IBM in the middle of the year. And those families will see a decrease in that income. I would hazard a guess that they don't qualify for the free and reduced, but the shock to their budget is just as real as in any other household that's suffering. And frankly, my amendment would allow half of the money proposed to go to reduce the rate of free and reduced, the other half to go to the school districts to allow them, because they know their students, they know their families, allow them to take care of the situations that don't fit into the approach of the one size, or the only thing we look at is if they are signed up for the free and reduced. And so the money still goes to help ensure that students get that lunch. And I haven't seen any breakdown, but I know some of the students that were concerned about that didn't receive a hot lunch, they had a substitute or no lunch. Some of those students weren't in this section of reduced lunch, and they would not have protection or relief from this bill. So I'm presenting this bill to allow half of the choice by the school district, and the school district can still do, if they choose, to get rid of the reduced lunch rate, or they can say we've got a need of students that don't fit into this definition. And I also want to bring up, I've got families and some single parents who I've talked to over the years. They are working and improving their income, and they have commented to me, several of where they had their free lunch and now they're doing better and they're on reduced lunch, and they have a pride in being able to better support their children. They're contributing. They're not there to where they're out of the reduced lunch gap, but they're contributing. And now we're going to say we don't want you to contribute. And frankly, leaving it up to the choice of the parent whether they request the free when we give the money to the schools. Because there are some parents that have worked hard and now feel as a better parent because they're providing more for their children. That might not be a lot of families, but that's important to some. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Quam. And members, House File 2480 assures that the reduced meals are paid in full, no ifs, ands, or buts. I'd I'd ask for a no vote. And I'm going to call for the vote on the A11 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
The A11 amendment, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. So I'm going to, at this time, lay over House File 2480 temporarily, and Representative Anderson up for House File 2280. Welcome to the committee, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for having me. I think the last time I was in one of your committees, it was Property Tax Committee, so it was very much deja vu. And I don't think I've ever shared this with you before, but it was in your Property Tax Committee. It was my freshman year. I was pregnant with my son, and that is the moment that my son kicked for the first time. I always think fondly of you.
Maybe he's going to be a wrestler, Chairman.
It could be a good sign, so thank you.
Yes.
Very good. Well, thank you. If you would want to explain your bill, Representative Anderson.
Sure. Can I have somebody move it for me, Mr. Chair?
Representative Erickson moves House File 2280.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Just a couple of things. We are here today to talk about the school lunch program and the fact that kids are being turned away. You heard stories from Legal Aid today of kids having a sticker placed on them saying that their account is low. But we all have been through the school experience and know how cruel sometimes kids can be and how humiliating that experience can be. In fact, the Commissioner of Education wrote a letter to the school districts admonishing them, making sure that they try and make sure that they don't pull school lunches from kids, because it is a hard thing for a kid to have to experience for something that is really no fault of their own or under their control. So what I have here today is a bill that takes care of that issue, and it's actually a stronger language than what you saw in the bill earlier today. No offense to Representative Seltzer, but I would like to put some language in here that makes sure that that piece alone, if you look on page 2, or well, I'm not sure what version you guys have, if you look on page 3, line 4, it talks about the fact that students will not have this stickering or labeling placed on them. So that's part of my language of my bill. And that's why I feel that this, hopefully, you'll send this bill forward, because it has stronger language that protects our kids and makes sure that they get school lunches. We heard today a lot about folks talking about this is the opportunity to respond. Well, I would beg to differ. We've had opportunity to respond to this issue in the past. Representative McDonald has been a champion of this issue, as well as Representative Newton. But this is certainly the time that we need to act, and I'm glad to see that everyone has had a change of heart and they're willing to move forward. I just hope that we move forward with the strongest language that puts our best foot forward. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank Representative Anderson for bringing this forward. Recommend an aye vote. I think it does address some of the issues that I've heard from my superintendents as well. It's a much more broad approach, and I think an approach that really does work, and I recommend an aye vote.
Very good. Thank you. Well, anything else? At this time, I'm going to move House File 2280 be laid over for possible inclusion into the finance report.
Any party rumors, Mr. Chair? I know you're running tight on time.
Or lay it over. Okay, or lay it over. So thank you very much. What did you say, Representative?
Any parting words, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you may.
Okay. Well, as I said, this is the stronger language of the two. So if you are truly serious of addressing this issue, I would recommend you do have the opportunity with Ms. Representative Seltzer's, but you could have the opportunity to move both bills. So think about that if you could.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, at this time, I'd like to move House File 2480 and recommend the bill be re-referred as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. So if Representative Seltzer, if you would just come forward to the table, please. And we've got some time for like a couple minutes if there's some comments or that before we vote on the bill. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, for some reason I've come up with an alternative idea. I know it's hard for you to believe that. I found it interesting on the testimony about the Angel account. And one of the things I just checked is if it's a PTA Angel account, the contributions from local community members is tax deductible. You know, if we change the tax law a little bit to a tax credit for contributions to the Angel account, local people could give the money directly to the school. the school would have the money to be able to provide the meals to the students that really need it, because they're the best deciders of this, without funneling money through the state of Minnesota. Now, if that same person who would help out locally sent that same dollar up to the state, and then we send it back to the school, for some reason, a lot of that dollar, a certain percentage of it, disappears in the process, and they get a much less than 100 cents on the dollar. So by financially incentivizing through the tax code a contribution to the school, I prefer a tax credit versus a tax deduction, you will have the money to the school, 100 cents on the dollar, they'll have the money to be able to give the kids that really need it, and where the state gets involved, you, a lot of times, for whatever reason, you create a lot of freeloading off government programs, and then you create a spiraling account that you continually have to increase funding for. So I just ask the author of the bill to consider that type of approach versus a state one-size-fits-all solution. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gunayim, thank you for your suggestion. What we have right now, unfortunately, is kind of a patchwork across the state where some school districts do serve all students regardless of income, and some, you know, are pitting, you know, academic and budgetary concerns against students, and it's a patchwork, and I respectfully submit that the bill that I am offering is clear, concise, with a steady stream of revenue so that we're ensured that every child who meets the guidelines for reduced lunch receives a nutritious lunch.
We'll go to Representative Woodard, Representative Selzer's final comments, and then we'll vote.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to thank Representative Newton for, I know that you've championed this for a while. I really wish we could have done it last year. And thank Representative McDonald for the amendment last year that would have done this. And so it is certainly time to do this. I do want to make just one quick comment, too, that, you know, in talking to our school superintendents and our nutrition directors in our schools, I think they do a fine job. And I know that there are some exceptions here that we've talked about as stories, but I do want to give them a little bit of credit for doing the right thing in 99.99% of the cases, and I want to thank them for that, and I look forward to getting this passed very quickly. Thank you, Chair Marquardt.
Well, thank you, Representative Woodard. Representative Seltzer, author of the bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. I want to thank Representative Woodard for his comments, because I was going to make the same comment, that our school districts, by and large, do an excellent job, and that now we have the opportunity to partner with them and provide them with the funding that will ensure that no child goes hungry in a Minnesota school because of an inability to pay. I want to thank Representative Wills for offering the same bill. So it's a great opportunity in a bipartisan manner to make the statement that no child shall go hungry in the state of Minnesota because of an inability to pay. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that we refer this bill to the 2480 to the General Registry.
Okay. Well, motion. I'll make the motion here. I think I already have the motion on the table. So we'll move a House File 20, renew motion to House File 2480 and recommend the bill be re-referred as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. There's
thank
a few stops there.
Sorry.
Very good. And just before we vote, thank you so much, everyone, for your patience here and on this very important topic and coming together. So I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion carried. So thank you very much, members, and we are adjourned.